Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about the experience of China at war, particularly with reference to the bombing of Chongqing in 1939. I'm reading today from Rana Mitter's brilliant book, China's War with Japan. And it's important to think of the historiography here and the memory of the war that exists in China. We traditionally or typically see World War II beginning in 1939. For the Chinese, the Second World War began in 1937 with Japan's invasion of China. You might even argue that Japan's annexation of Manchuria and the creation of the Manchukuo state in 1932 was the beginning of hostilities. And the war doesn't end in China, the conflict and bloodshed doesn't end until 1949, because there are 4 years of civil war from 1945 onwards. And then the point that Frank Dakota makes is in the first 10 years following the revolution, there was something like about 5 million deaths, by his estimations, from Mao's various campaigns. And that's before we get to the Great Leap Forward. So anyway, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves in a story of terrible tragedy in China, but certainly the 20th century in China was one of the most blood-soaked affairs imaginable. So when Rana Mitter is writing about Chongqing, here we have one of the key cities of nationalist China. The capital in 1937 had been Nanjing, and it had been indefensible. It was later seized in 1938, and horrific atrocities were perpetrated by the Japanese army, including germ warfare, the mass killing of prisoners, the mass rape of Chinese women, the mass killing of civilians, and the capital moved to Chongqing as a kind of a temporary respite. Anyway, Rana Mitter writes, "On the 3rd of May, the sky was clear above the southwestern Chinese city of Chongqing. The weather was sweltering. Not for nothing is Chongqing known as one of China's three furnaces, where temperatures regularly rise to 40 degrees or higher. At noon, Zhang Zhilou, a reporter for the Jinminbao newspaper, was getting ready for lunch. In the bustling city around him, the locals were going about their usual business. On the docks, stevedores hauled boxes on and off the ships that plied the Yangtze. Passengers descended from the boats. Descending from the boats would be mobbed by dozens of sedan chair bearers. Chongqing is famous as a Shancheng, a mountain city, far better to be carried up the steep hills that separate the river from the upper town, if you could afford it. In the markets, traders and their clients bargained for rice, vegetables and meat. The number of customers was greater than at any time in the city's history. In October 1937, the Nationalist Government of China had announced that it could no longer defend the existing capital at Nanjing to the east against a Japanese invasion that had begun 3 months earlier. Chongqing, therefore, became the temporary capital. Millions of refugees had fled westwards, and Chongqing's population then doubled in the size within 8 years. Aside from the crowded markets, the refugees' presence was clear from the ugly slapdash buildings made from mud and metal girders that had rapidly sprung up across the local landscape. These shanties gave an already slovenly-looking city an even more unkempt air. Suddenly, as he was sitting down to eat, Zhang heard a sound whose terrifying significance he knew well. "At about noon, we heard a short alarm signal," he recalled. "I didn't even finish my meal, but got ready to go and hide away in the air raid shelter in the newspaper offices in Jintang Street. Half an hour passed. Then an even more urgent siren began howling in short, continuous bursts. The last few people left the newspaper office and grabbed their possessions and ran down into the shelter. Zhang was lucky. The particular refuge where he found himself was one of the most advanced in the city, built by the government Air Raid Defence Agency. It was outfitted with electric lights, communications and equipment, and supplies of food and drink. Many of the city's poorer inhabitants only had makeshift shelters and were much less able to withstand a powerful blast from the sky. One man later wrote that in his household, when the air raid siren sounded, our whole family of more than 10 people just hid under the table. The British consulate in the city had placed a large Union Jack up on its roof to proclaim neutrality and warn off air raid pilots. But there were no guarantees of safety, even for the privileged. Not long before, a Japanese bomb attack on a water treatment plant had also hit the nearby diplomatic building. At 12:45 p.m, dots appeared in the sky, 36 of them, and they swiftly grew larger and louder. From airfields in occupied China, the Japanese Navy could dispatch Type 96 land attacking aircraft, able to fly over 1,000 kilometres on one single fueling. The Japanese were almost invulnerable and could bomb the Chinese government in exile into submission. So, the ability of the Japanese to control the skies, there was the Nationalist Air Force, only really becomes bolstered later on with the help of the Americans and the KMT Flying Tigers, who flew P-51 Mustangs and Kitty Hawks against the Japanese. The ability of the Japanese to control the skies is a key advantage, and it explains in the campaigns in China how Japan manages to have such phenomenal successes for so long, in much the same way that the Germans initially enjoyed phenomenal successes in Russia after having destroyed much of the Russian Air Force, the Soviet Air Force, in the first few hours of Barbarossa. The destruction of the air raid that Zhang describes in Chongqing was immense. He heard the noise of the aircrafts for about 2 hours, and then the rather pitiful counterattacks from Chinese nationalist aircraft that were all largely destroyed, and the contributions of Kuomintang anti-aircraft guns. When Zhang left the shelter, he discovered that so much of Chongqing had been destroyed that there was the odd building that's still standing that seemed almost a kind of like an anomaly. That there was, he wrote, that at one junction, a cluster of banks stood undamaged amidst the rubble of endless flattened structures. Even hours later, as darkness fell, the city was filled with sounds of moaning and screams for help, Zhang wrote. It was truly unbearable to hear. Between 1938 and 1941, Chongqing would be hit 218 times, and there would be a sum total of 11,885 deaths in Chongqing, as the Japanese used incendiary bombs and fragmentation bombs, designed principally to kill civilians. And on the day of the bombing that Shang recounts, Chiang Kai-shek was in Chongqing in his hilltop retreat at Huangshan, and was able to see the destruction wrought by Japanese air power close up. He wrote in his diary that more than 40 enemy planes came to Chongqing today and bombed the area around the Military Affairs Commission building. A lot of people in the city have been killed and wounded. The next day, he wrote, the enemy planes came again this evening to bomb Chongqing, and it's still burning. This is the most terrible thing I've seen in my life. I can't bear to look at it. God lives. Why does he not swiftly bring some disaster to our enemy? In David Kennedy's book, Freedom from Fear, he writes that the great disaster eventually comes with the Japanese decision to bomb Pearl Harbor, and that Chiang Kai-shek apparently was so overjoyed, knowing that America would now be in the war, he put on the opera Aida and danced around the room. At this point, of course, war has not broken out in Europe. Europeans were paying an awful lot of attention to what Hitler intended and were hurrying with preparations for the coming conflict. They were paying comparatively little attention to what Japan was doing in Asia. Even European colonialists in Asia, in places like Burma and Singapore, who were looking increasingly nervously at Japan, in some of their darkest imaginings, they couldn't predict what was going to come next. And it took until, obviously, late 1941, early 1942, for Europe's empires to be swept away in Asia. And there was not a lot of sense that European colonialists in the Golden Crescent, which I've talked about, from India all the way to Singapore, were being particularly listened to or paid attention to in general. Rana Mitter has some very interesting things to say on the historiography of the era. He says, for decades, our understanding of that global conflict, the Second World War, has failed to give proper account to the role of China. If China was considered at all, it was as a minor part actor in a war where the United States, Soviet Union and Britain played much more significant roles. Yet China was the first country to face the onslaught of the Axis powers in 1947, 2 years before Britain and France, and 4 years before the United States. And after Pearl Harbor, one American goal was to keep China in the war by holding down large numbers of Japanese troops on the mainland. China was an important part of the overall Allied strategy. China had much less ability to make its own decisions than the other Allies because it was so much weaker than them, both economically and politically. Yet the war still marked a vital step in China's progression from a semi-colonised victim of global imperialism to its entry, however tentative, on the world stage as a sovereign power with wider regional and global responsibilities.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
For instance, in 1945, it was the British who entered southern Vietnam, but the Chinese nationalists who entered and occupied temporarily the north. China went from being a country that had been colonised by the Japanese, that was facing almost a war of annihilation from the Japanese, to being a country who was policing its own borders and creating, as Chiang Kai-shek surely hoped to in Indochina, the beginnings of its own sphere of influence. It, ironically for Chiang Kai-shek, within 4 years, his rival Mao Zedong would be building spheres of influence in Indochina and in the Korean Peninsula as well. The history that is popularly understood in the West never really fully takes into account the actual cost to China of the Second World War. For example, 14 million Chinese lost their lives, an enormous movement of civilian refugees on a par with, if not greater than, the chaos wrought to Europe by the end of the Second World War. The destruction of the various modernisation, road, rail and infrastructure projects introduced by the Chinese nationalists during the 1930s. And it created the conditions for Maoism to triumph in China. Mao once famously, when in the 1950s, when he eventually met the Japanese ambassador to China, said, you know, we've got to hand it to you. Thank you so much. We would never have got into power without you. Actually, I correct myself. I believe that was the late 1960s. So it was the Second World War in China, as it did in Europe, created all the conditions for, you know, what Mao would have referred to as the Asian variant of Stalinism. Unlike war in Europe, where occupied countries saw their governments flee to Great Britain, the nationalists went into exile within China. So they, China being so vast, they were able to move inland, they were able to move westwards, and they were able to try to stay out of the range of Japanese aircraft. In other parts of China, the Chinese Communist Party was able not only to grow in influence, but to become a kind of a semi-autonomous government in its own right. And at the end of the war, an interesting process begins to emerge that almost parallels that of Europe. Not only are the empires, the European and Asian empires, particularly Britain and Japan, undone in China by the process of the war, but the new powers that will influence China's future up until 1949, the USA and the Soviet Union, replace them. So just as a great power politics in Europe was then replaced by superpower politics, the same is true in China. Between 1937 and 1941, the Chinese fought Japan on their own. They managed to pin down nearly a million troops in China, 800,000 in total, with a highly militarised army, a highly mechanised army, that was the most technically advanced in Asia and one of the most technically advanced in the world. And there was very little assistance, if any, from the outside world. The British did help to construct the Burma Road from Burma into southern China, and supply the nationalist forces, but that was pretty much the extent of it. One of the reasons for the urgency of Pearl Harbor, and perhaps the, shall we say, the recklessness of it, was that by 1941, after 4 years of fighting in China, that was placing an increasing burden on Japanese finances and resources, it became of life and death importance to make sure that a supply of cheap oil, particularly from the United States, continued to flow to China, or to Japanese forces in China. When that oil was cut off, then seizing the Dutch East Indies becomes a matter of life and death. Otherwise, Japanese tanks stop working in China, Japanese aircraft stop flying. The first thing you have to do is to knock out the American Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, because they will be the police force in the South China Sea and the Pacific that will come and stop any seizure of the Dutch East Indies. This, combined with an attack on Singapore, an attack on Malaya, an attack on Burma, which was, again, part of the grand design, really the jewel in the crown for the Japanese, is China. It's China that will decide everything. And to withdraw from China, as per Roosevelt's requests, would have presented the Chinese government with an impossible loss of face, and also Japanese society with an appalling dilemma. Many Japanese soldiers had already been lost in China already, and it would have been a humiliating climb down and an admittance to the Japanese people that the entire operation had been a huge and costly error. In 1937, Chiang Kai-shek, even in the eyes of China's communists, was clearly recognised as the only man in China who could realistically hold the country together and present resistance to the Japanese. The irony for him, of course, is that he does win the war, but within 4 years has lost China to Mao and the Communist Party. By 1937, the future of Mao's communists was reasonably bleak. They were a small party on the periphery of Chinese society, having been chased into the wilderness by the nationalists along the supposedly heroic Long March, which killed really about 90% of those who took part in it. At the end of the war, the Chinese communists controlled an area of 100 million people, and they had nearly a million soldiers under arms. So the war had been an immense success for them, and they had been an opportunity. It had been an opportunity, really, for Mao to claim a lot of kudos, but avoid a great deal of the actual actual fighting, which would have led to huge losses of men and attrition. By keeping soldiers back, allowing the nationalists to do most of the fighting, the real battle, as Mao saw it, would be against the nationalists once the Japanese had been defeated. By the time Pearl Harbor happens, Mao is fairly confident that the Japanese have made fatal errors which will lead to their undoing, so he can sit back and wait for what he views as the real fight. China's Communist Party today in the 21st century is keen to associate itself with the efforts against the Axis powers. Ironically, it was Chiang Kai-shek that was appeared at places like the Cairo Conference. There is a ludicrous Chinese film, I forget the title of, which has Mao there instead, but obviously Mao never met Churchill or Roosevelt or, well, during the war anyway, Stalin or anybody else. And the idea that China was one of the key decision makers within the Allies is far-fetched. Roosevelt had very little time for Chiang Kai-shek, and there was no doubt some sort of anti-Asian bigotry happening there, that the view that people like Churchill and Roosevelt had of people east of Suez was that they do as they're told, and they don't really attend conferences to talk about things. That's for European colonialists to discuss, and American imperialists too. One explanation as to why the history, the wartime history of China, has really slipped away is the Cold War itself. After 1949, when it became clear that China was not going to follow the American path to modernity, not only did the narrative about what the war had been cement itself in China in the interests of the communists, but Western historians and pundits and thinkers essentially write the Chinese out of the story. The important bits of the story are the in Asia, are the kind of the war in Burma to seize back what the Japanese had stolen from the British Empire, and the island hopping MacArthur and the great naval battles of people like Halsey and Nimitz in the Pacific. That becomes what's important. The perhaps the biggest struggle of the war, which is in China itself, becomes edited from the story. And of course, it becomes harder for Western audiences to pay attention to and understand parts of the story of the war that don't, for a long period of time, actually feature European soldiers or British or American soldiers in any large number. That said, there actually were significant numbers of American servicemen on Chinese soil during the later stages of the war, during particularly Japan's Ichigo offensive in China. It was motivated by a desire to seize the territory upon which American air bases were situated, which were currently bombing Japan. Before island bases could also be seized by the Americans, which would step up that bombardment. So there were American servicemen there anyway. Okay, well, I'm going to finish this before it gets too long or boring, but we're going to return to Reiner Mitter's brilliant book in the not-too-distant future. And do remember, if you can help us out by sponsoring Explaining History on Patreon, we'd be much obliged. Do give us a shout, and all contributions gratefully accepted. Hope you're having a great sunny Monday, and I'll catch you all soon. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.